Hello, Literary Hangover listeners. Thank you for joining us again this week for another nonfiction edition of the show with Chris, who will be joining me soon. I was going to play the following clip as a cold open, but then I realized the language in it would really embarrass anybody who isn't playing it, isn't listening to it in headphones. So, got a few seconds to turn it down, maybe. The following is a kind of now famous 1981 clip of Republican strategist Lee Atwater, who was a advisor to Reagan and Bush, HW, and sort of a Southern strategy guy. He's from Atlanta, Georgia. This is from a 1981 interview that wasn't, the audio of which wasn't unearthed until 2012, in which he explains how appeals to racists became more and more abstract. Enjoy the show.
Here's how I would approach that issue as a statistician or a political scientist, or no, as a psychologist, which I'm not, is how abstract you handle the race thing. In other words, you start out, and now y'all aren't quoting me on this. You start out in 1954 by saying nigger, nigger, nigger. By 1968, you can't say nigger. That hurts your backfire. So you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you're getting so abstract now, you're talking about cutting taxes, and all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and the byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than whites. And subconsciously, maybe that is part of it. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that if it is getting that abstract and that coded, that we're doing away with the racial problem one way or the other. You follow me? Because obviously sitting around saying we want to cut taxes, we want to cut this, and we want is much more abstract than even the busing thing. And a hell of a lot more abstract than never, never, you know.
Welcome to Literary Hangover. I'm your host, Matt Leck. With me once again is Chris Liel.
Hello.
Today we are talking about Nancy MacLean's 2017 book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. It's hard to bring up this book without sort of bringing up Jane Mayer's Dark Money. It's sort of the companion piece, maybe slightly more polemical to that, would you say?
Yeah, for sure. Dark Money is, you know, Jane Mayer does a fantastic job in Dark Money, but it's just like a, you know, paper trail, the who, what, when, where. Follow the money story, and it's incredible, but it also isn't very accessible at times, and so this is the more polemic version of that.
Yeah, and it's been fairly controversial. It was picked by Oprah, which really upset a lot of people.
Book club.
Basically, the contention is that there's a fifth column being funded by quote unquote libertarians, like Charles Koch, mainly Koch. And it needed a sort of intellectual underpinning, and a guy named James Buchanan, who started out in Virginia, and ended up founding the George Mason sort of libertarian economics department.
The Virginia School of Economics, as they say.
It's got a ring to it, historically speaking. He founded the Thomas Jefferson Center at the University of Virginia in Charleston. Or wait, no, that's not right. No,
Charleston, South Carolina.
Yeah.
Charlottesville.
Charlottesville, sorry, that's what I meant, yeah.
And then he went to Virginia Tech, and then he went to George Mason.
He also spent a little bit of time in UCLA.
Which the book said was just as conservative as the Chicago School and Virginia, which was like kind of shocking.
Well, what I liked from the UCLA portion, and we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves, but that's fine, is that the economics department was the one UCLA faculty department that didn't stand with Angela Davis, the black professor who's, you know, sympathetic to the Black Panthers, as, you know, you should be. And Reagan was like, no, we need to get this Marxist out of here. And for some reason, UCLA economics department was quiet about that. And instead, Buchanan was, and I'll just cover this because we're not going to really focus on this chapter, but Buchanan wrote a book along with somebody else about how we need to change the incentives for people in schools, and that basically MacLean says laid the underpinnings or you know, sort of Machiavellianized, led to this corporate university state. It could just be that it rhymed with exactly the prevailing sentiment that led to a neoliberalization of higher education.
I mean, there is some interesting logic. It's a shame. I guess we're not going to cover more later, but I have a quote from in here, but I mean, the concept was that, like, you know, there's, in 1968 was right, an incredible, there were student protests all over the world that year.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're like, well, you know, if they were focused on paying more and they were more financially tied to this, they'd be, you know, more focused in school perhaps, or we can make things, you know, more difficult for them in that respect. So they're not focused on, you know, social issues.
Mm-hmm. I remember there's a Milton Friedman thing cited where he's like, you know, students, yeah, they'll be able to either pay for it or borrow against their future wages, because in his thinking, higher education would necessitate mm-hmm. higher income, which I think is part of the problem with higher education now, is we have that being an expectation of income.
Right. I mean, and the strategies is the same that they use. I mean, even more broadly outside of the students, right? Like, I mean, a lot of, if you're, you know, broke, you know, you're not focused on, you know, changing the world or anything else. You're just focused on getting by.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, especially, I mean, you see the results of the student situation. Now we have $1.4 trillion in student debt, you know, so they made students bear this economic cost at the same time. Relatively, you know, if inequality is increasing, that means the share of the pie for everyone else is shrinking, right? So they're like, here, spend more money to compete for this shrinking pool of, you know, lucrative jobs.
So, yeah, well, it's also worth noting that the same set of people, the same lineage, is still complaining about higher education and the snowflakes at college campuses, you know, not being open enough to, you know, right-wing ideas. So they didn't really fix the problem that they set out to solve. But there's been controversy over this book. And I'll even say that it...
She plays a little loose with her quotes.
You could say that. We'll get into some a bit more specifically to sort of give you the actual flavor of what that's like. But, you know, Rick Perlstein, a historian that I am a fan of... he was one of the liberals who, it wasn't just libertarians who really got upset about this book. Rick Perlstein also Facebook posted about it. Here it says, yet more damningly, in my opinion, the foundation of the entire book is a conspiracy theory that suggests that if you understand this one secret plan, you understand the rise of the American right in its entirety, which suggests you don't need to understand any of the right or any of a score of other important tributaries, some of them not top-down conspiratorial at all, but deeply organically bottom-up, blah, blah, blah. Now, I think that would have been my criticism of this book had the libertarians not even freaked out about it, right? Like, I want to know more about people like Murray Rothbard. I want to know more about, like, different Mark Pellerin Society people. Like, all those people are suspect to me, and I don't view history typically as something that comes from, you know, one Machiavellian individual.
The great man concept.
With that said, James Buchanan ticks a lot of boxes. And what I've taken, and I've read quite a bit of the criticism, I've read the Munger criticism, which I didn't think was very impressive. We're going to get into that more deeply. The one that I did think was fairly well done, although I have some reservations about some of the conclusions it drew too, was The Sound of Silence, a review essay of Nancy MacLean's Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America by Jean-Baptiste Fleury and Elaine Marciano. I'm not sure where this is published, it doesn't say. Maybe it wasn't published yet, but it was good. It's a very long, substantial piece. The basic point is that in certain areas, like say in Chile, Buchanan may have been more peripheral to some of the decision making than actively making the decisions or guiding them. All of which amounts to me to basically saying Buchanan is somewhere between MacLean's sort of writing as a libertarian Machiavelli, or the libertarians basically say he is a libertarian Forrest Gump. Just happens to be at Mont Pelerin, just happens to be in Chile with Pinochet, just happens to be at George Mason in the Mann Seminar, just happens to be in Byrd's Massive Resistance Virginia. Like, these are just coincidences, and I think that is a totally plausible thing, but this isn't a book about James Buchanan, as far as I'm concerned. It uses James Buchanan as a sort of vehicle to travel through what I actually do think is adequately proven in this book as a stealth attack on democracy. And it's impossible looking at politics today to say that we're not actively, you know, withstanding an attack on democracy. Just a few things that, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, I feel like any criticism of this book in that respect, I mean, you're absolutely right. Like, I feel like if you want a more, you know, dry, straightforward paper trail book, that's what Dark Money is for. Right. And what you have to keep in mind in some of these criticisms with this book is that, and they do talk about this as a strategy there, is that this is a strategy of that movement, is to purposefully be opaque and bleak, mm-hmm. and boring, and they want your eyes to glaze over. They want you to, you know, it's like a whole bunch of groups, and they're like, oh, public choice theory and all, you know, and they just, they want you to get bored. And also, this is a story that lasts over decades. And we're talking about a whole pipeline between funding and academia. A
whole bunch of careers.
And politicians themselves. So, you know, it's not the most exciting story as is. I mean, you know, for some people, right? Like us junkies or whatever. Sure, like I loved Dark Money, but it's not a book you might give your mom or something over the holidays. Like you might want to give her Democracy in Chains. So that's what she does. She has to find a narrative. And, you know, and I agree. It's obviously I think he's somewhere between there, but look, if you have stated goals, you know, that you need to reverse engineer, you know, your way to justifying your aim, your means, I mean, you know, you're going to need some intellectual, and if that's public policy, you're going to need some intellectual cover. Mm-hmm. You're just going to need it, right? Like, oh, we know we want to cut regulations and taxes. So we need to find someone to justify that academically.
Right.
You know, and he was crucial in that, right? So like Koch and even before Koch and, you know, DuPont and these others are involved in sort of
DuPont
like...
DuPont makes an appearance.
Right. The direction and the money in here. But you need this... Buchanan is the academic part of this pipeline.
Right. Know? Yeah. And I mean, the irony here is that what the libertarians are really upset with McLean is the sales part of her book. Because really, I think this is the pressures of publication, right? Like she has access to this archive. The publisher's going to be like, yeah, let's inflate the sense of importance of this guy you have this archive to, right? Like that's going to happen. And you kind of have to know that's a market pressure in publishing these days.
And just to have that narrative, someone you can identify with. And sort of if this is a companion piece to Dark Money, Dark Money really was more, it was broad, but it, you know, there was a heavy emphasis on the Kochs, right, and their family. So you have the money and the high level piece. Now maybe you focus on an academic piece. It makes sense to choose a different, you know, target.
Right. Now I have a list here of things that I say are all things being pursued to some degree by the right and all under false premises and pretenses, I guess. So first thing, the stolen Supreme Court thing, right? Mitch McConnell saying, let's let the people decide. Well, who won the popular vote in 2016? Right.
Or in 2000.
Right. And then you talk about the Federalist Society, who's basically picking all the judges for Republicans. And then the Manny Seminar, which we'll get to later. You also have gerrymandering. Now, you could say both sides do it, but let's just go through some of these state house results. In North Carolina, Republicans won 47% of the popular vote. The seats they won, 54. In Pennsylvania, they won 45. The seats they won, 54. In Michigan, they won 47% of the popular vote. The seats they won, 53. And in Wisconsin, they won 45% of the popular vote. The seats they won, 64%.
Yeah.
This doesn't happen by accident.
Yeah, both sides do it, but the Republicans are better at it. And the Republicans are better at it because they know they have a demographic bomb on their hands. And so, you know, they need to get ready for this.
And they're also better at it because the Constitution favors reactionaries and property, right? Like, and empty space and
they
land.
Just had more, like Dark Money talks about Project Red Map. They just had, right, you know, this momentum, this libertarian momentum, all this money just looking for ways, you know, to change the system to their favor, you know, to do what, you know, Buchanan calls a constitutional revolution, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he was thinking really big.
Mm-hmm. Then we have voter suppression. Voter ID laws are completely without real life justification. They're entirely to suppress the vote of certain communities, namely like poor minority and college student. You can guess which way those people vote. And it's so infuriating to have to talk to anybody to try to debunk any of this in the actual person, right? Like, because a voter ID thing is something that, oh, people should be able to prove that they're, like, it sounds common sense to certain people who aren't read in or a bit naive about what's really going on.
Yeah, and the thing is, look, we already have horrible voter turnout, okay? You know, it's hard to get people to get out and vote. And so any sort of additional blocks or additional measures that people want to put in place to, oh, you know, all this, you know, voter fraud or this. No, there's not enough people participating in the process. So anything they do to make it tougher, that's by design. There's an agenda.
Right. We also have attacks on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. All those, again, under false pretenses. Like, the Social Security is going bankrupt. Of course, that's bullshit. But even major news outlets still run that shit.
Right.
Was an interesting part of, you know, basically... in the book they talk about, or one of Buchanan's main things. So in economics, this sort of like self-interest was a big, you know, revolutionary concept, in that, you know, people are, you know, just trying to maximize their own, you know, outcome. But if everyone does that, then somehow magically you get this utopia.
Mm-hmm.
And so they inverted that law. Well, they just took that same logic and put it into the public sector space. They were hoping for an inverse outcome, and they wanted to delegitimize the public sector. This was the start of them. They wanted you, you know, I view it as akin to cutting your own left arm. Like, you have to realize that the government, in its ideal form or whatever, there's many flaws right now, but it is the representation of the public will, right? It's democratic. We represent it. We vote for it. And so they wanted to delegitimize it so that people wouldn't seek government to solve anything.
Yeah. Munger... and actually a lot of these academics who take issue with McLean spend a lot of time defending public choice theory, and my response to that is to make the masturbation hand motion. Nancy McLean has this really great section in 215 showing how a libertarian applies this public choice theory. This is from page 214. Even before Obamacare was enacted, a public choice economist funded by the Liberty Fund, Gary M. Anderson, produced a study alleging that the field of public health was, from its beginning in the early 20th century, nothing more than, quote, a major device used by organized interest groups to redistribute wealth to themselves. Amity Schles, a libertarian journalist on the Wall Street Journal editorial board and author of the best-selling book based on Buchanan's ideology, The Forgotten Man, came to a similar conclusion as the fight over Obamacare began. She, quote, found that public choice theory explained everything, end quote, including that, quote, health officials' interest in testing small children's blood for lead made sense when one considered that finding poisoned children validated their jobs. There's public choice theory. I'm sure some non-libertarians have used it to some decent effect. But in my opinion, like, I don't think the left particularly needs to be told that politicians act in sort of self-interested ways, right? Like, this is not breaking news to me at all. And I don't know. Do you have any more?
Well, but the fact is, they're using that to try to delegitimize them. Even there, you know, like, it's, I mean, it's sort of perverse, right? It's like I said, it's like me trying to convince you, Matt, to cut off your own left arm. And I'm like, dude, your left arm, man, like, it's got its own thing. Like, it's getting in the, dude, your right arm, like, needs to be, your right arm needs its own liberty to do whatever it pleases. And there's, your left arm is imposing tyranny on it. Like, and I just, like, convince you to cut your left arm off. And it's like, that's like, it's so bizarre. But this quote here, that this isn't about Buchanan, but about Koch in general. But it was saying that Koch viewed Friedman and Alan Greenspan as sellouts to the system because they sought to make government work more efficiently, when the true libertarian would be tearing it out at the root.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that sums up so much of this book. Like, this isn't a book about, like, Republicans versus Democrats. It's a book about this far right, basically borderline anarchy libertarian sect that is fighting against both the other actual Republicans and Democrats, against everyone. They're not willing to compromise. Like, that's all you need to know here. They don't want to compromise. They're gonna, right, they tearing it out at the root. They don't want to make government work better. They don't want government at all.
Yeah, exactly. So let's go to maybe the first. Libertarians took issue with the very first section where Nancy McLean situates this in the context of John C. Calhoun. Tyler Collins said that John C. Calhoun Tyler Cohen, the libertarian, who we'll get into later, who is currently in Buchanan's place at George Mason. But Cohen mentioned John C. Calhoun in the lineage of public choice. Now, other people have said that maybe public choice as practiced by James Buchanan isn't what he meant. But anyway, let's go to this part about John C. Calhoun, I thought was to start this off.
Outraged Southern planters dubbed the 1828 federal tariff on imported manufactured goods the Tariff of Abominations. Designed to help the infant industries of the United States grow after the War of 1812 with Britain, a war that had exposed America's grave economic weakness, the protective tariff most benefited the region interested in nurturing manufacturing, the Free States of the Northeast. The tax disproportionately pinched the export-oriented cotton-growing South, whose most powerful citizens, owing to the profitability of slave-based production, had little concern for economic diversification. Calhoun cried foul. "We are the serfs of the system," he fulminated. Rage over what he viewed as discriminatory taxation led him to radical positions that could all but undermine the effective framework of government that the Constitution's authors had crafted only a generation earlier. "A government based in the naked principle that the majority ought to govern," Calhoun warned, "was sure to filch other men's property and violate their liberty." Stepping up to lead the first region-wide tax rebellion in U.S. history, Calhoun was also moving willy-nilly to question representative government itself. It may surprise today's readers to know that in those days, Calhoun and like-minded large slave owners found themselves to be very much alone in their questioning of the legitimacy of taxation to advance public purposes. Such concerns did not arise where slavery was absent. The historian Robin Einhorn has shown, in the first careful study to examine state and local tax practices in early America, Einhorn found that where they were free to do so, voters regularly called on their governments to perform services they valued and elected candidates who pledged to provide them. They believed, as Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. later put it, that taxes are the price we pay for civilization. What early Free State American voters liked about tax policy in their self-governing republic was that they, the people, decided by majority rule what they wanted their elected officials to do and how to tax for it. For these citizens, liberty meant having a say in questions of governance, being able to enter the public debate about the best way forward. Tracing such debates from the colonial era to the Civil War, Einhorn concluded, "American governments were more democratic, stronger, and more competent where slavery was negligible or non-existent. They were more aristocratic, weaker, and less competent where slavery dominated, as well as more likely to be captured by the wealthy few who turned them to their own ends. Voters in free states wanted active government. They taxed themselves for public schools, roads to travel from place to place, canals to move their goods, and more. In the southern states, the yeomen of the backcountry, where slaves were fewer, often tried to get their governments to take up their concerns, but found that planters saw threats to their property in any political action they did not control, even if the yeomen actually were demanding roads, schools, and other mundane services." The irony of all this is vast, as Einhorn points out. "The anti-government rhetoric that continues to saturate our political life is rooted in support for slavery rather than liberty. The paralyzing suspicion of government so much on display today, that is to say, came originally not from average people, but from elite extremists such as Calhoun, who saw federal power as a menace to their system of racial slavery."
Now that, I think, this is the context this book needs to be read in, which is the sort of conflict between democracy and capital. And this is where and one of the main criticisms that where people say McLean doesn't know what she's talking about, I think, are disingenuous. I go to Munger here, who's a Duke professor, which is the same with
colleagues.
Yeah, they're colleagues. He's one with fairly significant professional entanglements. He was a friend of Buchanan.
He's got Koch money.
He says Buchanan was not a racist. He has received grants from the Koch Foundation. He writes that McLean, here he says, Buchanan did not believe in unlimited majority rule. But then, as he often rightly said, nobody believes in unlimited majority rule. Democracy is and must be a balancing of, on the one hand, the rights of minorities, and on the other, the ability of the majority to have its way within the domain established as political by the Constitution. That's another thing that is remarkable about Democracy in Chains. McLean does not assign Buchanan a strawman position. She correctly gives Buchanan's position as being the mainstream view, the one that eventually, the one that everyone actually agrees with. And then she tries to defend the straw man position that no one actually believes. I'll skip just a little bit forward here. Students and McLean, apparently, have never considered the problem of constitutions that was the center of Buchanan's thought. We need to rebalance two considerations, the will of majorities and the right of minorities. The U.S. Constitution is explicitly anti-majoritarian, both in terms of its establishment of a court system that later developed judicial review to thwart majority will, as in the case of Roe versus Wade, and in its use of the Republican form of selecting representatives in prescribed ways. Now, that this generic talk of majorities imposing their will on minorities is interesting academically, but every single one of these people who have made this complaint about Nancy McLean, by not including what McLean is actually saying, which is that these libertarians want the wealthy and propertied to be considered a minority class that's protected with the same protections that we protect gay people with and black people. No. That's the fundamental problem. It's like, this is not a problem of general majoritarianism. And by not getting that specific, I think they're being almost maliciously dishonest.
Yeah, to take this back to, you know, the last podcast we did together, I think, or maybe it was two, but you know, Corey Robbins, The Reactionary Mind, right? This is the counter-revolution adopting this revolutionary rhetoric, right? Liberty, right? We want liberty and economic liberty, right? Or minority protection for the elites, right? And right. So there was a quote, and she was sort of, this is when she played sort of fast and loose with, I guess, because I'm not sure, I don't have a hard copy of the book, so I'm not sure what, the quote was their goal was to save capitalism from democracy permanently.
Yeah, and that might have been, one of the things I take issue with is McLean will sort of, imply their underlying motivations in italics. I don't think that some of the more, square historians take issue with that. I think that she puts quotes and quotation marks and footnotes on is probably enough. I mean, look, this isn't a straight history. This is a raising of the alarm. And that's why this book is more interesting than a straight history. This isn't time for dispassion. Like, there are actual legislative coups going on as we speak in North Carolina, in Wisconsin, in a couple of other places, right? Like, there's an actual anti-democracy thing. This is the time for the benefit of the doubt. I mean, I'll go from another Munger thing here. McLean violates a fundamental principle of historical and philosophical biography, the principle of charity, which, according to the esteemed philosopher Simon Blackburn, requires the analyst to maximize the truth or rationality in a subject's sayings. Now, I don't buy that. I don't buy that for people whose entire careers have been underwritten by oligarchic foundations. To go back to a little bit to the whole thing about, are we focusing too much on Buchanan? We focus too much on the Kochs, right? The Kochs aren't the only ones out there. You got the Scaife, Olin, you got all these different types of rich right wingers. And obviously this doesn't happen on the left. Like, George Soros is the only one people can actually name. He's not left. He's right. Liberal.
But arguably Kochs and Buchanan are the, you know, two of the most prolific, right? I mean, the Kochs have been politically for almost a half a century now, right? And they've spent many billions and billions of dollars and many billions of dollars.
Yeah. And it's funny because, like, again, to Munger, I'm kind of anticipating going through this. I was going to go through this a bit more methodically, but he has this quote here in the Pinochet apology section, where he says, 6 degrees of Pinochet is almost as big of a parlor game for progressive academics as 6 degrees of Charles Koch. Sorry, folks, nothing to see here. Buchanan had no practical impact on the Chilean constitution. Now, what if a person has a few degrees of separation to both of those figures at the exact same time? That's who we're dealing with Buchanan, right?
Well, I was going to say, a lot of his criticisms are like ignoring, you know, like the Atwater quote that we heard at the beginning of this episode, you know.
That whole like premise.
Right, you know, and he likes to hide behind, he's like, what, public choice? I mean, it's, you know, I practice it, or, you know, I'm a, and all this stuff. And you just like forget that it's like, well, people do have an agenda. You might not, right? And maybe Buchanan, maybe his ultimate agenda, you know, maybe he was just more purely academic and that's what he wanted, but that doesn't matter. People used him as a cover for something else, you know?
Yeah. So, we need to look at what a pure academic that gains rather a large amount of success in milieus of like segregationist Virginia, what that guy actually looks like. Yeah. And I think we can get into some of this later. There's plenty of actual quotes that say this guy was a racist. Now, McLean says, stresses in the introduction, he wasn't especially racist for his time. I think that's probably true too. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that the racism that we can document, for instance, like him in UCLA saying like not a whole lot of blacks here, order's under control. Like,
right, to say he's not racist at the same time in Virginia, in the same state, as he's making all these arguments to just, you know, oh man, if the government's going to force us to let black people go to school with white people, let's just get government out of education altogether. At the same time that that's going on, it was, Prince Edward County, right? Yeah. In Prince Edward County, so this is after Brown v. Board, and during this strategy of imposition, Prince Edward County, Virginia, they shut down all the public schools for 5 years, mm-hmm, just to avoid teaching black kids. So, you know, all the white kids, you know, they were better off. They would send them to private schools. But, I mean, you know, many of the African-Americans in that state didn't go to school for 5 years just because they were throwing a fit, basically.
Yeah, and here we'll get to where Buchanan got his sort of center at the Thomas Jefferson Center for Political Economy and Social Philosophy. This is in Chapter 3 here. We're going to actually meet one of the DuPont relatives that he is connected to. Okay, anyway, here's this section of Buchanan's early academic life in Virginia.
The private mission statement for the Thomas Jefferson Center for Political Economy and Social Philosophy that Buchanan submitted to University President Colgate Darden in December 1956 made a lot of promises. It promised to be guided by two traditions, that of the old-fashioned libertarians, whose ideas encouraged laissez-faire economic policies in 19th-century England and America, and that of the Western conservatives, who feared the revolt of the masses, as the title of one text put it, and sought new ways to ensure social order. The document also made clear who would not be allowed to participate. Anyone who, even inadvertently, would value security, the New Deal's mantra, above liberty, and who would replace the role of the individual and of voluntary association by the coercive powers of the collective order. The latter would include supporters of industrial unions and government intervention in the economy. Buchanan, by contrast, pledged to train social philosophers, men, for the university admitted only men then, ready to put into effect a society based on liberty. With a hint of defensiveness, knowing that such exclusiveness was indeed unusual in an academic enterprise, he assured, "To start in a small way to produce such a line of new thinkers is an eminently legitimate endeavor for a great university." The center's members, Buchanan vowed, would take up such matters of concern to Virginia's governing elite as the growing power of labor unions, the correct relationship between the federal government and the states, made all the more urgent by Supreme Court decisions such as Brown, what he depicted as the problems of equalitarianism, among them income redistribution, the welfare state, and the tax structure, his archaic way of speaking of egalitarianism, an indicator of how his program would approach them, and the social security system and its threat to individual initiative. More specifically, the center aimed to combat what its founders referred to as social engineering by changing the way people thought. They hoped to break the powerful grip that collectivist ideology already had on the minds of intellectuals, as Buchanan later put it. Almost all professional economists then accepted the pump-priming doctrines of Keynes to ensure demand to keep the economy growing. Nearly everyone, even as they differed on the particulars, believed that in the age of the giant corporation, America needed what the liberal economist John Kenneth Galbraith had recently termed countervailing power, organized workers and consumers. The federal government must also put its weight on the other side of the scale to ensure fair play and economic stability. Put simply, most Americans then trusted their government. In such an era, Buchanan said, our purpose was indeed subversive. Darden knew precisely what Buchanan meant by collectivist solutions to social problems. His father-in-law was Irénée DuPont, the former president of the DuPont Company and one of the nation's wealthiest men. He was also among the most right-wing of the rich. DuPont so hated FDR that he had helped found the American Liberty League in hopes of restoring an employer's paradise by nipping the New Deal in the bud. But he and his corporate colleagues had muffed the job. Their arguments were so crude and self-interested that their mobilization redounded to the president's advantage, enabling him to denounce the millionaires as economic royalists bent on keeping others down.
I actually have a book recommendation on that exact topic. The DuPonts were one of the original families that basically, they were one of the early Kochs. I mean, they're still probably doing it, but that's a lot of money. The book is, I have it here. Invisible Hands by Kim Philbs Fine goes deep into that history of how FDR was like able to take on these dark money groups and basically humiliate them. And that's what the job is now. Do you have anything else to say about that section?
Well, I was, you know, on this last quote and then harking back to even, you know, they didn't even like the New Deal, right? That's why in the newsletter that we, you know, info or newsletter that goes out every Sunday, you know, it's the newsletter for, you know, we talk about the new Gilded Age, right? I mean, other people are talking about that now too, but like, that's why, because it's the same economic policies. They want it, like, New Deal was even way too progressive for them. You know, they don't even want these people, these borderline anarchists don't think that there should be, you know, departments of education. They don't think that, you know, should produce roads. Like, I mean, it's crazy how extreme it is. And they've been successful at co-opting the entire party into their favor.
And they know there's a leg that they can bring along the people that don't understand that the party's changed. Right. I'm going to read from the Thomas Jefferson Society documents here. Just a section I thought was kind of interesting. Care will be given, or care will be taken in the selection of such scholars to ensure that encouragement be given to these individuals interested in broad social problems, not in technical expertise. As a single example, this is the single example they decide to mention, the individual who desires to pursue the philosophical implications of progressive taxation should be chosen in preference to the student who desires to work in linear programming. These fellows will be expected to participate actively in the intellectual activity of the center, although they will have no direct educational responsibilities. So, now look, if this was not, as Nancy McLean suggests in this book, a precursor to this sort of advanced, like Mercatus Institute at George Mason, which Buchanan also worked at and later was, like, I think, president of the economics department there. And if Buchanan didn't think of this himself, he's very clearly performing it, right? Whether this sort of idea is original to him or how original to him is something that the academics can squabble over. But it's definitely what the problem is, right? Yeah. Now we'll move a bit further to the where they start resisting what was called massive resistance. So Brown versus Board of Education said, you got to integrate your schools, Virginia. And Virginia's like, I think we just won't do schools for a while. Yeah. and they're like, no, you have to do schools. And some plucky Virginia Thomas Jefferson Center economists have a plan of how we can make, quote, everybody happy. And by everybody, it means the people that they really want to make happy.
In January of 1959, the courts put an end to the uncertainty. Two sets of judges, federal and state, ruled the school closure laws unconstitutional. As long as public schools operated in any locality of the state, they found, it was a violation of the guarantee of equal protection to shut them down in another. Conceding that his state must finally obey the courts, the governor convened an emergency session of the state legislature to revoke the school closure legislation and form a commission to propose a new course of action. While the state legislature began to work out a new plan, Buchanan and Nutter put the finishing touches on their own plan. On February 10th, 8 days after Norfolk reopened its schools, they sent a private report to all the members of the new commission. The economists made their case in the race-neutral, value-free language of their discipline, offering what they depicted as a strictly economic argument on matters of fact, not of values. Yet they were, in effect, urging the state to ignore its concerned white parents and continue to stonewall the African-American seeking equal schooling. And they knew it, which is why they noted that by intervening they were letting the chips fall where they may. While most Virginians now assume that the path forward would include gradual...
I just want to say, just highlight the callousness of that statement. Like, letting the chips fall where they may, which they may fall in a way that completely leaves off entire generations of black kids getting educated. If that's where the chips fall...
No, it's the market, you know.
Yeah, I guess.
It's the market.
While most Virginians now assume that the path forward would include gradual integration in most parts of the state, albeit with mechanisms holding it to a minimum, Professor Buchanan and Nutter made the case for the very opposite, unlimited privatization of education. As believers in individual liberty, they said, they approved of neither involuntary or coercive segregation nor involuntary integration. Tax-funded private schools were the answer. They offered a plan they believed could salvage what remained of massive resistance while surviving court review. How? Privatize education, but do so on the basis of strictly economic arguments. First and foremost, they contended that public schools, which they insisted on referring to as state-run schools, had an effective monopoly. They lacked adequate competition because on their own, few parents could afford alternatives. As a result, like all monopolies, state-run schools had no incentive to improve. Privately operated schools, by contrast, would have to compete for students, so they would have a strong incentive to try out a diversity of curricula, not only encouraging experimentation, but meeting different tastes. In essence, every parent could cast his vote in the educational marketplace and have it count. To foster this system, Virginia should provide a tax-subsidized voucher to any parent who wished to send a child to a private school for any reason. Those schools, being private, would enjoy autonomy, admitting or rejecting students as they chose to, without government interference. The importance of the economists' case rested less on what they proposed than on how their proposals were framed to undercut the arguments of the parents and others who were saying that Virginia simply could not afford to subsidize private schools to salvage segregation. Not so, the Chicago-trained scholars countered. Those who argued this way were making an accounting error by failing to consider the significant dollar value of existing school facilities. If authorities sold all the buildings and equipment to private owners, that would equalize the operating costs of the two systems, and the private schools would prove their inherent superiority. They assured those charged with recommending a court-proof approach that fears that industry will leave Virginia unless we keep the traditional system of public schools were groundless. Corporations would not care who ran the schools, they said, as long as good education was available. All that matters for the economy, the two scholars maintained, was that the state government support some school system, cheaply and efficiently. How that schooling was provided was immaterial.
I just want to point out this part. Every parent could cast his vote in the educational marketplace and have it count. Now, these aren't votes, right? This is money. If we're doing vouchers... this is not votes anymore. This is money, which presumably you could augment your voucher with more money to get your kid into a nicer school, right? And who has money in Virginia in 1960? This is the thing that really, like, that libertarians, they just cannot ever grapple with history, including James Buchanan. Not just history. If they just dealt with the history of wealth accumulation... But they don't even deal with that. They act as if everybody has the same sort of market power in some sort of weird way, right? Like not realizing that if you do a market-based solution after you have been segregating and making a permanent underclass based on race, that they're not going to have the market power to compete for the best education for their kid. I don't have any patience for libertarians that are like, well, if you look at their public choice, look out fucking side.
It's being willfully ignorant of all these racial issues. That's what it is.
Like
to pretend that everyone is on some even playing field or whatever, or, you know, so.
that serious people are giving Buchanan the benefit of the doubt and stuff like this. We might go into some more of his, like, that's explicitly racist thing.
But that's why it's so perverse then, you know, even with the race issue and them sort of, you know, like we're saying this, like, you know, the Corey Robin idea of, like, counter-revolution, you know, versus revolution. And so there was a quote here, this guy T. Coleman Andrews, he was from Virginia, and he was the IRS commissioner under Truman. So this is the guy running the tax department, and here's a quote for him. He said, "The graduated income tax was a devouring evil tantamount to slavery." Mm-hmm. That's a quote. Called it, quote, discriminatory. And then he quit his job at the IRS commissioner under Truman, and then he ran for president under the Libertarian ticket, and talked about the, quote, dangerous trend towards socialism. So, like, I mean, it's just so perverse, you know, to out of one side of your mouth espousing these ideas that are so ignorant of these racial issues, and then on the other side pretending like you think slavery was bad, and, you know, and like pretending like you're suffering just as bad as they did.
Right. And just to double back to, I think, the main thesis that I don't think is very is significantly challenged by any of the McLean's criticism, which is that, like, say the voucher, the whole school voucher thing. Now, thankfully, since Trump won, the Democrats have kind of been off of that, right? Like, even Hakeem Jeffries, who is an Obama guy, recently, like, got pissed at a reporter saying, like, I don't deal with those. I haven't taken money from them in a couple cycles. But charter schools to this day, the language that they're sold in is efficiency and, like, let's innovate. They're still segregation academies. Here's a Boing Boing article from 2018 here from June. Tax-funded charter schools textbooks deny evolution, teach human-dinosaur cohabitation, endorse slavery and indigenous genocide. It's
casual.
It's so they can lower standards and teach their kids what they want and teach the kids they want. And go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, just in order to be able to do that, that's what they do. They degrade the public education offering. Like, they don't want it to be, you understand, there's an argument on the right of whether we should even have a Department of Education or not. They're not looking to actually make it work well for everyone. They want it to be shit. So then they can say, look, this is shit. We should privatize parts of this, and we could do, you know, the market could do it better. We can do it in our own way. It's like, I mean, they're just, you know, trying to delegitimize the government itself.
Yeah, like, let's get really abstract and think of how this could be better for everybody and not realize, like, I mean, it's not that they realize, like, that's the problem, is so much of this, so much of the defense of Buchanan and the attack on McLean is that, is the suggestion that McLean can't know what's in Buchanan's heart. It doesn't fucking matter. And it barely matters what's in his academic writings, to be honest. Like, I don't think it matters that Buchanan at some point said he favored a universal estate tax.
He's just a fig leaf. He's a fucking fig
leaf. The Copperleys don't
give
a shit.
For their corporate anarchy that they want. That's all. He's an academic fig leaf for that. And they'll be able to reverse engineer whatever they want for that.
Now, here is where he gets a bit more conspiratorial. This is his third century movement. And we also talk about Henry Manny.
The reality had to be faced, and might even prove useful. Most citizens knew little about government. Gordon Tullock called it rational ignorance. The individual voter had scant effect on outcomes, so why bother to follow politics closely? Busy with other matters, they devote relatively little time and effort in acquiring information about social policy alternatives. Rather, they accept what they are told, by news sources they trust. And so it was incumbent on the cause to change what they were hearing, and from whom. His vision was to start by converting people of power in domains that mattered: politics, business, the media, and the courts. This was why Buchanan had invited a group of close associates to his cabin in the country that March to test out his new plan. If a history of the third century movement is ever written, it can talk about origins in a log cabin deep in the Virginia mountains, he forecast with glee in convening the gathering. A roaring fire will add a bit of conspiratorial flavor to the conclave of a small circle with a big plan for the future. It included his longtime ally Tullock, his Academia in Anarchy co-author Niko Stevlatoglu, his fellow Mont Pelerin Society economist J. Claiborne LaForce Jr., former department chair at UCLA, and the department chair at Virginia Tech, who had brought in Buchanan's team, Wilson E. Schmidt, now President Nixon's Deputy Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury. Schmidt had been seeking the help of like-minded economists to prevent higher taxes from becoming the answer to the emerging fiscal crisis. What the cause needed, Buchanan told the men he brought together, was to create, support, and activate an effective counterintelligentsia to begin to transform the way people think about government. A kind of bottleneck existed in which liberal intellectuals influenced the media, which in turn influenced the elected political leaders, thwarting the men's shared cause. The center-left all but owned the university, and its intellectual establishment effectively indoctrinated political actors in both parties. Because of this, any attempt at fundamental change would be frustrated and subverted. It was essential, therefore, to pull together the like-minded and seed a new crop of surrogates who could be indoctrinated with intellectually compelling arguments, and then mobilized, organized, and directed to spread them in a strategic manner. If the job was done right, ultimately, in time, this new vast network of political power will be the establishment. It sounded like the plan he had first proposed to President Darden all those years ago, but on a far grander scale. This was a multi-tiered vision no longer focused on developing an academic school of thought. He had created that, after all. The new stage was practical strategy. Buchanan made one more important point to his invited guests. The key thing moving forward, he stressed, was that conspiratorial secrecy is at all times essential. Now, tonight, in his Richmond banquet address, he would make the dream public, but not the stealth organizing to realize it. The issue that the third century faces, he announced, was how to put manacles on what he referred to as Leviathan. He spelled out what he saw as the world historic peril of government growth. The Civil War had ended the possibility that states might use the threat of exit to check federal action. The concept of states' rights had also lost its power. As a result, since the Great Depression, we have witnessed a continuing and accelerating growth in the American Leviathan, evident in the enlarged public sector. The monster was on a rampage.
And then later in the same chapter, Nancy McLean goes into what became of this third century movement.
In designing strategy to build the needed counterintelligentsia, Buchanan advised money talks. Creating a gravy train would help bring men into the fold and get them committed to a set of values so they would do the work that needed doing. Remember, to him, venal self-interest was at the core of human motivation.
I'd just like to pause here for a moment to think about, you know, this public choice insight into how cynical and selfishly motivated public officials are. Maybe if we apply that to economists, it might have some insights as well. But anyway, I digress.
The trick was to establish new providers. Buchanan doubted that business leaders could be approached directly to fund the cause, because few were likely to see value in a long-term intellectual project. The best way to reach them was through political leaders who saw the need and could persuade them. The Reagan connections to corporate donors illustrated the potential, and Ed Meese's presence at the event augured well for the future. Did Buchanan's third century project succeed? Some parts did, some didn't. Those that worked set the model for others. Some early achievements came from an organization Buchanan set up with Meese in the first of many collaborations between them. Another had enormous long-term impact on the courts. The California-based Institute for Contemporary Studies, ICS, connected scholars with right-wing political actors in the state and businessmen recruited by them. Relying for startup funding on the Skay Family Charitable Trusts, its staff stayed in regular contact with the governor's office. Among those recruited were the future Supreme Court Justice, Anthony M. Kennedy, then a Sacramento attorney, as vice president, and a board of directors that mingled sound economists with agents of corporate interests, such as the California Farm Bureau Federation and Shell Oil. ICS set out to remedy misunderstanding about how our free institutions ought to work by targeting opinion-making institutions, especially the mass media. One project drafted PBS to let Governor Reagan speak directly to youth in the state's 1,100 school districts. Another aimed to learn what was being taught in pre-collegiate economics education and propose new curricula. The Institute for Contemporary Studies also planned various ways to get its version of economics into the public debate. Its staff trained businessmen, for example, to offer a persuasive libertarian analysis of social problems to the mass media. They also hired journalists and other professionals for rewriting technical research material by the economists into a form usable by the media. as an ICS fundraising brochure noted, economics is an underlying concern, if not the primary element of practically every social issue.
It sounds like Marxists.
It was time to teach opinion makers and decision makers to understand the field as the ICS economists did. Corporate donors concurred. By 1980, their ranks included Exxon, Mobil, Shell, Texaco, Ford, IBM, Chase Manhattan Bank, U.S. Steel, and General Motors, backed by the Olin, Scaife, and Smith Richardson foundations.
That's another. See, when I say McLean focuses too much on Cokes, the Scaifes and the Olins, they're all in here. And that's why I think this book is really useful and a really... She's concentrated the narrative to a point where it completely fucks with the whole libertarian project. That's the real charm of this book, I think.
Another highly influential initiative came about partly as a result of Buchanan's concern, expressed to one of his funders in 1970, that we are witnessing genuine subversion in our law schools. He was likely referring to the role public interest attorneys had been playing in the war on poverty and in suing government bodies to make them more accountable to minority citizens and other impoverished Americans, and to the new reliance on class action lawsuits by social justice litigators. Law school faculty fostered both developments. Meese, an attorney by training, shared Buchanan's concern, and ICS devised an effort to train antitrust lawyers and selected newspaper journalists in its brand of economics. ICS worked on this effort with the Law and Economics Center at the University of Miami. That center was run by Professor Henry G. Manny, a leader in the emerging field of law and economics, a field dedicated to shaping the understanding and practice of law in a manner that CEOs and CFOs could and did appreciate. Bringing a corporate-oriented cost-benefit analysis to regulation and legal liberalism more generally, the field sought to do to mid-century legal thought what public choice was doing to social science thought about government. In the words of one history of the effort, to undermine the intellectual foundations on which its arguments and its claim to represent the public interest were based. Manny's own work of the 1960s had argued, for example, that insider trading was good for the economy and that hostile takeovers offered an ideal way for investors to control managers. Manny had been among the handful of scholars Buchanan first thought of for his Third Century project in 1973. And no wonder, for he too saw the need for an organizing strategy and had the talent to convene the right players. I think we are not too far away from a period when there will be conservative counterparts to the ACLU, Manny consoled Buchanan during the campus upheaval, and when there will be public interest lawsuits brought on behalf of property owners. Lawsuits waged on behalf of property owners. It was that sense of possibility that led Henry Manny to launch an annual Summer Economics Institute for Law Professors, in which some of Buchanan's colleagues served as lecturers.
You know, they mention like legal fields and stuff here, and they in the book they talk about Buchanan shifting the goal. Mm-hmm. Buchanan et al., okay, you know, this was the general goal, was the change from, quote, who rules to the rules, right? And mm-hmm. so that's why they, you know, wow, if all these, you know, candidates are going to be elected that we don't like, well, then let's just change the rules. And so they focused this economics, the marriage of economics and the legal profession has been like highly, you know, libertarian or conservative,
right.
basically.
And just antitrust law in, right. yeah, on itself. Yeah.
And Buchanan referred to it as a constitutional revolution. And the thesis was that majority rule had caused, and this was a quote from the book, had caused corruption and risk to capitalism. And therefore, the current constitutions had been failures.
Hmm.
I mean, that just shows you their mindset, you know, how they're thinking about this.
And also what was going on in the country at that time. And they right. were concerned about the threat to capitalism. This Henry Manny is very important. This law and economics shit is not fake. So I'm going to read from, this is from the critique by the one I thought was, if you are skittish and don't want to be into conspiracy theories and you want to read something that inoculates you against the excesses of McLean style, this Jean-Baptiste Fleury and Marciano thing is fine. I think it misses the mark on a few things, but they point out this. Even if one admits that Buchanan's ICS allowed Manny to be successful, the question is to what extent Manny's program influenced courts. Nicknamed Pareto of the Pines and Pareto in the Palms, The program consisted of crash courses in economics aimed at legal scholars, judges, and lawyers. Mann himself recounted the story. Additional details were given by Mayer, who noted, quote, by one count, 40% of federal judiciary participants in Mann's seminars, including the future Supreme Court justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Clarence Thomas. This is also what McLean stresses. By 1990, more than two of every five sitting federal judges had participated in his program. A stunning 40% of the U.S. federal judiciary had been treated as a Koch-backed curriculum. That figure, she says, is just one index of how successful Mann had been, and the only one she actually provides, one may add. Thus, the impact of Mann's seminars is judged by the number of attendees. This is obviously not sufficient. One would need evidence, or at least examples, of how the course may have affected the content of participants' subsequent decisions as judges. None are given now. Correct that McLean doesn't point that out, but some subsequent scholarship has. Elliot Ash from the University of Warwick, Department of Economics, along with Daniel Chen and Suresh Naidu, wrote a piece called Ideas Have Consequences, The Impact of Law and Economics on American Justice. The abstract I'll read here. This paper provides a quantitative analysis of the effects of the early law and economics movement on the U.S. judiciary. Using the universe of published opinions in U.S. circuit courts and 1 million district court criminal sentencing decisions linked to judge identity, we estimate the effect of attendance in the controversial Mann Economics Training Program, an intensive course run attended by almost half of federal judges between 76 and 99. After attending economics training, participating judges used more economics language, rendered more conservative verdicts in economics cases, rule against regulatory agencies more often, and render longer criminal sentences. These results are robust to adjusting for a wide variety of covariates that predict the timing of attendance. Comparing non-Mann and Mann judges prior to program start and exploiting variation in instructors further assuage selection concerns. Non-Mann judges randomly exposed to Mann peers on previous cases increased their use of economics language in subsequent opinions, suggesting economic ideas diffused through the judiciary, with economic ideas moving from regulatory cases to a subsequent criminal ones. Now, that reading that abstract is maybe not as clear as I can. I can just show Chris a graph, and I'll include it in the notes here, of the degree of change they've grafted out. Chris, if you can see this. Mm-hmm. So before, this is Mann attendance and appellate rulings against labor and environmental agencies. Before Mann attendance, they are clearly on the
they're below trend.
Labor environmental side of things. And afterwards, they all skyrocket.
Yeah, it's a perfect, it's like an upward sloping line here. Yeah. Is the relationship.
So this is one of the things that this critique of McLean is pointing out. Like, she doesn't show evidence for this. Well, maybe that's not her job. Maybe the
point, that wasn't her background.
Yeah. Like, and the thing is, like, this is the test that we should run all of these libertarian economics through.
Right.
And if it doesn't do that, then I contend that it won't be libertarian economics anymore.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they do talk about, you know, obviously their influence in economics at some certain point in this book, but this isn't her forte. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did notice, you know, for the narrative, she starts this story, right? She chooses Buchanan as the protagonist. But the starting point is Brown v. Board of Education. What is that? 54, I think. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And I'm like, okay. But also, there's always this underlying economic motive, you know, like they were, you know, the DuPonts of the world, like they were already around, like people hated FDR the whole time. So there was already there. She doesn't mention it here, and I'm not citing anything, but I'm sure there was already some existing, you know, cabal of, you know, economic royalists, as Roosevelt would have called
right.
them at the time, you know, that were plotting, you know, hoping for things like this.
I mean, and I just think about it, like, let's say the economic royalists in Harry Byrd's Virginia, right? Like, even though, let's say, the ones that weren't virulently racist, if there was any of those, they would have still sided with, as capitalists, as libertarians, they would have sided with the racists because the racists were who had the money, right? Like,
That's what happens when you segregate society for that long. And that's what happens when that segregated society was a slave society before that, right? Like, right. This should not be hard calculus for somebody who's spending an entire lifetime in academia to understand, unless you specifically, your job was to never understand that part of this stuff. Later on, though, so yeah, this is in 1997. The Mont Pelerin Society's golden anniversary. Now, Mont Pelerin Society, that is something I want to spend more time on. The golden anniversary, this is in 1997, and this is some more on the Manny Buchanan stuff.
The Mont Pelerin Society's golden anniversary provided an opportunity for Buchanan and his colleague, Henry Manny, the newly retired dean of the George Mason School of Law, to define the content of the push to come. Manny had by then more than proved his value to Koch. His summer legal programs had provided intensive training in applying free market economic analyses to legal decision-making for law professors and for federal judges, luring them with luminaries and luxury accommodations. To name just one index of how successful Manny had been, by 1990, more than 2 of every 5 sitting federal judges had participated in his program. A stunning 40% of the U.S. federal judiciary had been treated to a Koch-backed curriculum. Not surprisingly, early discussion between Manny and Buchanan identified several barriers to economic freedom to be overcome. Excessive government regulation of business was an overarching theme, with the biggest threat, the two men now determined, coming from the environmental movement. Because environmentalists were, in the eyes of Manny and Buchanan, on a quest for control over industry, they had to be not merely defeated, but defamed, with their personal hidden agenda exposed. Another impediment to the society's vision of liberty was government-backed health and welfare, which impaired the normal workings of labor markets. Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, employer-provided pensions and insurance, all those needed to be phased out, or rather, over time, converted to individual savings accounts. Any modern democracy's tax policy was likewise trouble, because the voters' inevitable egalitarian instincts would lead them, if unobstructed, to redistribution. To solve this problem, they had to bring about the end of the graduated income tax adopted after 1913 with passage of the 16th Amendment in favor of a single-rate flat tax. Another absolutely critical target for the new century, they agreed, should be education. As the most socialized industry in the world, the GMU team complained, public schools, from kindergarten through university, nurtured community values, many of which are inimical to a free society. Its continuing dominance was an affront to the cause that, since Milton Friedman's 1955 manifesto, had sought to end the government monopoly of schooling. Finally, the golden anniversary discussions should also figure out how to deal with feminism, which the men found to be heavily socialistic for no apparent reason. A kind of cultural war was therefore in order against this movement that relied so heavily on government action. The two men, it should be noted, acknowledged the surprising resilience of the enemy. But whom they defined as the enemy may surprise you. It was not, as most of us would assume, liberalism. It was socialism. Soon after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Buchanan had observed that socialism in the small was on the ascendancy. What he was referring to was not what you and I were taught in school as the definition. Socialism, as the Mont Pelerin Society members defined the term, was synonymous with any effort by citizens to get their government to act in ways that either cost money to support anything other than police and military functions, or encroached on private property rights. By that definition, socialism was indeed alive and well in the 1990s. What concerned them even more was that it was not just liberals who exhibited these socialistic tendencies. By 1990, with the fall of the Soviet Union, even conservative heads of state such as George H.W. Bush and Margaret Thatcher no longer saw the need to devote vast sums to an arms race and a Cold War against the USSR. But rather than return that money to the people from whom they took it, the wealth makers, they were speaking of a peace dividend, of shifting vast sums of money from the military to homefront concerns. Abetting that socialist tendency, Buchanan and Manny believed, was passage of the National Voter Registration Act of 1993, a measure pushed for by organizers of low-income Americans who wanted to bring their voices into the political process. As Alex Kazar writes in his History of Voting in America, the National Voter Registration Act
was the final act of the drama that had begun in the 1960s. It completed a lurching yet immensely important 40-year process of nationalizing the voting laws and removing obstacles to the ballot box that had been put in place from the 1850s to World War I to deter non-elite voters. It instructed states to facilitate participation in elections by allowing citizens to register by mail when visiting public agencies for assistance or when obtaining or renewing licenses at motor vehicle facilities, hence its nickname, the Motor Voter Act. By 1997, 9 million net new voters had joined the electorate. To believers in voting rights, it was a huge achievement. To those who scorned the idea of a broad and inclusive electorate, it was cause for mourning. "We are increasingly enfranchising the illiterate," grumbled Jim Buchanan, "moving rapidly toward electoral reform that will not expect voters to be able to read or follow instructions." It could have been Harry Byrd speaking.
Yeah, that's a racist expression of an idea. And I'll come back to this, which I, this critique, which I've plugged as maybe the one you should read if you want to read one, but I'm going to just read a part of it here. "There is no evidence showing that Buchanan was even racist at all. The qualifying uniquely is useless and value-laden." So remember, McLean said there's no evidence, like Buchanan wasn't uniquely racist. So they don't think that's a good enough, you know, fig leaf, I guess. Olive branch, I guess. "Then, in the absence of evidence," and this is the second step, McLean builds then her narrative to show that Buchanan is guilty of association with massive resistors. Yes. "Although evidence shows that members of the Thomas Jefferson Center were in contact with people such as James Jacob Acton, this is not enough to demonstrate a common plan to undermine public education or desegregation. The main problem, this kind of charge, blah, blah, blah. No evidence exists that Buchanan was not racist either, i.e. Buchanan did not explicitly take a position against racism." One can criticize the fact that Buchanan, as a social scientist working in an environment in which segregation was obviously a huge problem, failed to explicitly weigh in against the prejudice. Ding, ding. After all, Gunnar Myrdal had done so in his influential An American Dilemma, 1944. But Myrdal was an exception within the community of economists. As of the late 1950s, few economists even considered that discriminatory practices stood as a primary topic for neoclassical economics. In this respect, Gary Becker's 1957 publication of his PhD dissertation on discrimination stood as a lonely contribution. This is probably a consequence of one of the premises upon which Chicago and more generally neoclassical economics rests. De gustibus non est disputandum. That economists did not discuss tastes explain their case claims of value neutrality. In that case, it meant neutrality with respect to racial prejudice. While this neutrality was most certainly a mark of Buchanan's training as an economist, it is a different thing to conclude it bears a mark of some nefarious ideological commitment. Hence, although such silence in is retrospectively deafening and worthy of condemnation, McLean's charges about Buchanan's intent are not convincing. That's completely discrediting of that entire field, in my opinion. This isn't just about being neutral with respect to racial prejudice. It's not just racial prejudice. This is racial.
It's not a sign in itself, right?
Yeah,
this is, like, he didn't ever explicitly say anything about racism.
This isn't about prejudice. This is about allocation of resources and wealth, right? Like, and where you are placed in a sort of legal framework, right?
Yeah.
That you could be neutral as a Chicago economist to the idea that in the South particularly, but all across the country, white people, especially white people from a certain class, like Anglo-Saxon or whatever, whatever it is, they're going to have more of the capital. And if your analysis of political economy doesn't involve any sort of like appreciation or deconstruction of that set, it's completely worthless. You're not doing anything. You're not doing real world economics. But I think there actually is evidence that Buchanan was a racist. From this book, actually, I'll cite a couple. Page 35. "Indeed, rather than sympathize with the plight of black Americans, Buchanan later argued that the failure of the black community to thrive after emancipation was not a result of the barriers put in their way, but rather proof that, quote, the thirst for freedom and responsibility is perhaps not nearly so universal as so many post-Enlightenment philosophers have assumed." That's a racist thought. I'll go to page 94. "When the city of Charlottesville..." That same year abandoned the segregation-enabling freedom of choice for public school policy that would allow more integration, Buchanan grumbled to Tulloch that now, quote, the leftists will be attracted to the University of Virginia. Page 100. On a visit to Los Angeles, he revealed that he disliked the city and found the school impersonal. He went despondently, knowing that he would no longer be the big fish able to make an outsized splash in a small pond. He also seemed uncomfortable about the number of African Americans living in the city and attending UCLA, commenting to Tulloch after a visit to San Diego State about how there were, quote, very few blacks in evidence, end quote, and the students seemed more orderly than UCLA's. I don't think it's fair to say that he's not racist at all based on this. First of all, you can't successfully navigate the waters that he's navigated and not be racist. Like, you wouldn't have got a position at University of Virginia. You wouldn't been allowed to open up a Thomas Jefferson Center in Harry Bird's Virginia if you weren't, like, at least okay with racism and racism being, like, enacted in policy. So yeah, enfranchising the illiterate, James Buchanan.
By the way, we haven't mentioned yet, but that asshole won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1986.
Yeah. Right.
And 1986.
And there, I guess McLean notes that some people were like, why do we need a Nobel Prize to know that, like, public officials might be self-interested?
Yeah. Was that after Chile too? Pinochet, wasn't that?
Yeah, it was a little bit after.
Yeah, so that had already happened.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're deep in the Reagan years.
Well, yeah, and we can talk about, we'll talk about Cowan here. Let's talk about Chile a little bit. I have a article here that was by Tyler Cowan of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, the libertarian school. He writes about a lot of the critique is that Buchanan didn't have as big a role in the constitution process in Chile as McLean says he does. And I think that that's fairly well argued in certain places.
Hold on, should we add some context? So what was the year? So there was this guy, Allende, and he was a socialist president.
Salvador Allende.
Democratically elected leader of Chile. And, you know, we didn't like that. So some local people on the, you know, with U.S. help, right? I'm sure we were involved in that. Overthrew Allende and installed Pinochet, who was a military dictator.
I think Kissinger is like, yeah, give Allende the hook.
And he was, you know, fascist, right-wing, like pro-capitalism. You know, so that's... And then eventually they hired, in part, Buchanan and others, apparently, to come and consult on enshrining all of these, you know, these libertarian pipe dream rights of capital that they want enshrined in a constitution and putting checks on the majority will.
Yeah.
So he had a big hand apparently in forming their constitution.
Yeah, and from this Tyler Cowan thing, he says, if we examine reforms in non-communist autocracies, those of Augusto Pinochet's Chile were probably the most successful. So, yeah, he's a fan of, not a fan. Like, this is the problem with, like, they say, I'm not being a fan. I'm just, you know, calling balls and strikes here, right? Like, this is how it ended up. But people say that, yeah, Buchanan didn't have a huge role in the Constitution, but even Tyler Cowan suggests...
But his idea, whether or not he did personally, his ideas certainly were. Like, it was this school of thought that was this conservative economic thought being enshrined.
Yeah, here's from Cowan. The Chilean reforms were strongly informed by market-oriented ideas from the United States. Pinochet wished to make Chile a great country and a strong power, and he saw economic liberalization as a means to the end. He relied on American-educated advisors, many of whom were market-oriented economists. Many of these individuals had studied at the University of Chicago with Milton Friedman and Arnold Harberger, among others. These advisors came up with the bulk of the reform proposals, and Pinochet was willing to push them through. In addition to the Chicago economists, it has been noted that the writings of Friedrich Hayek, James Buchanan, and Gordon Tulloch played an active and vital role in the dissemination of neoliberalism in Chile. Now, whether you want to say that McLean overstressed the constitution part, if you're going to make that case, you should also make the case that the bigger role he played in was the economic reforms, but none of these people did that. Oh, and just another thing I'll pull from this Tyler Cowan thing before we go into Tyler Cowan is the thing I'm most afraid of Republicans doing and Coctopus making Republicans do is a balanced budget amendment. Do you want to explain what that would mean for, like, say, Medicare for All or the Green New Deal?
Yeah, it would kill them. It'd destroy balanced budget. I mean, you would have to, right, you basically cut and run deficits, which is counterintuitive, which goes against the prevailing economic consensus and how to deal with the downturn. Even the Republicans who will say they don't believe in Keynesian economics and stuff, guess what? When the economy tanks, George W. Bush did it. Donald Trump has been doing it, right? Fiscal stimulus. You spend to stimulate the economy. That's Keynesian economics.
Yeah, like our current national debt is not a severe problem compared to like climate change.
The way we're accumulating it now is especially irresponsible. But if we were accumulating debt, you know, for investing in our people, whether it's healthcare or other means, then that's a productive use of. But if we're just giving money to rich people so they can buy more helicopters or something, I mean,
right? But so James Buchanan is Tyler Cowen. James Buchanan has been one of the leading advocates of balanced budget proposals and constitutional spending limits. A balanced budget proposal would require the government to cover its expenditures with taxes each fiscal period. It could allow an out if a sufficiently high percentage of the legislature was willing to vote that a crisis exists. So it's clear why Buchanan was invited by a guy like Pinochet, right? Like, this is not a smear. This is synergy between ideas and a fascist. This is who they need to come tell us, how are we going to keep control of this? How are we going to keep control of all the money if we just let people have democracy? Like, that is a problem for capital.
And the Constitution has been so ridiculous that there's still, like, they still deal with this today. Like, they required you to have all these crazy super majorities to make any changes to the Constitution. It's like so impossible to change. It's crazy.
All right, now here's this from the last section here.
If you tell a great lie and repeat it often enough, the people will eventually come to believe it.
Now, I'll just cut in here that it's coming in pretty hot to do a Goebbels quote. To talk about libertarians, but I respect it. I respect it immensely. Thanks, Nancy.
Joseph Goebbels, a particularly ruthless yet shrewd propagandist, is said to have remarked, "Today the big lie of the Koch-sponsored radical right is that society can be split between makers and takers, justifying on the part of the makers a Manichaean struggle to disarm and defeat those who would take from them. Attend a Tea Party gathering and you will hear endless cries about the moocher class. Read the output of the libertarian writers, subsidized by wealthy donors, and you will encounter endless variations. David Bowes of the Cato Institute, to choose just one, speaks of the parasite economy that divides us into the predators and the prey. Addressing an audience of $50,000 per plate donors, Mitt Romney famously remarked that 47% of voters were, in effect, leeches on productive Americans. Is there any evidence to suggest that close to half of American society is intent on exploiting the rich through the tax system? That they contribute nothing while using government to gang up on a defenseless minority that somehow, all on its own, generates wealth? Is it true that the wealthiest among us are being unfairly fleeced by government? If so, how do we square that with what is now common knowledge? That the secretary to a billionaire will often pay a higher tax rate than her boss? Might such motivated arguments belie a deeper purpose, a compulsion to control others, to limit their freedoms in the name of ensuring one's own liberty? Surprisingly, the cause, so secretive in so many other respects, has given us the answer. Charles Koch has always argued that his vision of a good society will bring prosperity to all. But his trusted cadre, the people he relies upon to justify and advance his messianic vision, apparently believe otherwise. They have sketched out the society that will emerge if their cause succeeds, while wiping their own fingerprints from the story of its emergence. What does that society look like, and what will they have to do to our people and our democracy to secure it? Koch learned as a young adult from his mentor Baldy Harper that the great social problem of our age is that of designing the preventive medicine that will stop the eroding of liberty in the body politic.
Baldy Harper, a John Birch Society guy, I believe.
Harper warned that once the disease has advanced, a bitter curative medicine is required to gain already lost liberty. James Buchanan revealed just how bitter the medicine would be. People who fail to foresee and save money for their future needs, Buchanan wrote in 2005, are to be treated as subordinate members of the species, akin to animals who are dependent. Tyler Cowen, the man who succeeded Buchanan and now directs the Causes Base Camp at George Mason, the Mercatus Center, exactly. has explained that with the rewriting of the social contract underway, people will be expected to fend for themselves much more than they do now. While some will flourish, he says, others will fall by the wayside. And because worthy individuals will manage to climb their way out of poverty, that will make it easier to ignore those who are left behind. Cowen foresees that we will cut Medicaid for the poor. Also, the fiscal shortfall will come out of real wages as various cost burdens are shifted to workers, from employers and a government that does less. To compensate, the chaired professor of the nation's second wealthiest county recommends, people who have had their government benefits cut or pared back should pack up and move to lower-cost states like Texas. Granted, he says, Texas is skimpy on welfare benefits and Medicaid coverage.
Tyler Cowen's a psychopath.
And nearly 3 in 10 of its residents have no health insurance, but the state does have jobs and very cheap housing to offset its subpar public services. Indeed, Cowen forecasts, the United States as a whole will end up looking more like Texas. His tone is matter-of-fact, as though he is simply reporting the inevitable. And he enjoys great authority, as his blog, The Marginal Revolution, is the most visited intellectual blog in professional economics, known for criticizing Republicans as well as Democrats, and also respected for Cowen's signature incorporation of economic concepts to analyze cultural phenomena from food to travel. He presents himself as a pragmatic libertarian. Indeed, the blog's motto is, Small Steps Toward a Much Better World. Yet when one reads his flip remarks on the fate now facing his fellow citizens, with the knowledge that he has been the leader of a team working in earnest with Charles Koch for 2 decades to bring about the society he is describing, the words assume a different weight. They sound like a premeditation. For example, The Economist prophesies, lower-income parts of America recreating a Mexico-like or Brazil-like environment, complete with favelas like those in Rio de Janeiro. The quality of water might not be what U.S. citizens are used to, but partial shantytowns would satisfy the need for cheaper housing as wage polarization grows and government shrinks. Some version of Texas, and then some, is the future for a lot of us, The Economist advises. Get ready. Those who subscribe to the libertarian philosophy believe that the only legitimate role of government is to ensure the rule of law, guarantee social order, and provide for the national defense. That is why they have long been fervent opponents of Medicare, Medicaid for the poor, and most recently, Obamacare. The House Budget Chairman Paul Ryan has explained that such public provision for popular needs not only violates the liberty of the taxpayers whose earnings are transferred to others, but also violates the recipient's spiritual need to earn their own sustenance. He told one audience that the nation's school lunch program left poor children with a full stomach and an empty soul.
Yeah, so like I said, psychopaths. Now, Tyler Cowen was on the receiving end of one of these misquotes that is commonly cited, and I want to go through it. Andy Seal of the Society for U.S. Intellectual History wrote a good piece on the controversy over democracy and change, it's called, on July 17th, 2017. And he goes into this this supposed misquotation of Cowen. And it did not... It doesn't please everybody, but I think it's actually, this is really the nub. And if you want to be upset with McLean, then I think you can be. I'm not about this. So here's where it says, the document in question, why does freedom wax and wane? And this is where I pulled the stuff on Buchanan and Pinochet and Pago. Why does freedom wax and wane? Although there seems to be a second version available online here. The crucial sentence in question is in full the following. While the weakening of checks and balances would increase the chance of a very good outcome, it would also increase the chance of a very bad outcome. When McLean quoted this sentence, she left out the while and that it would also increase the chance of a very bad outcome. Thus, in her book, it appears simply as the weakening of checks and balances would increase the chance of a very good outcome. Her critics see this as prima facie evidence of a bad faith effort to distort Cowan's meaning and make him appear to be anti-democratic. I think that's immediately debatable, however, because by her lights, any open-minded contemplation of the possibility of weakening checks and balances is anti-democratic. That's what Cowan is doing here, entertaining the possibility that weakening checks and balances could produce a desirable outcome. Let's think about it this way. If I said, while permitting five-year-olds to be employed in manual labor would increase the chance of a very good outcome, it would also increase the chance of a very bad outcome. What could we conclude? That I was advocating child labor? No, that would be too much. But that I was open to the idea? Yes, that is a fair reading. What do you make of that? I think that's fair. Like, I can understand why people are mad, but I think those people are missing the forest for the trees.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I don't remember her. I didn't get her name or the chapter, but it was early on. And there was, I just thought it was interesting. They were talking about, this was like in the 50s, very early on. There was a female candidate in Virginia.
Yeah,
did you catch
the pro-labor woman?
Right, exactly. She was, she seemed very smart. But she had noted, she was talking about declining demand for agricultural jobs as a reason to spur public investment.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, yeah, like, duh, obviously that didn't go over well, but because, you know, Virginia was very conservative, but I mean, that's the same situation that we have here. Like, they were going through declining agricultural demand. We're deindustrializing right now, mm-hmm. right? And that's why we need to invest, right? That's why there's this talk of like a Green New Deal. We need to invest in something different because, you know, we're deindustrializing. All these tech companies that are growing up, like, they don't need to hire as many people as a car manufacturer did.
Yeah, it was Dr. Wenzel. I'm not sure what her first name is, but yeah. And I mean, that's the same thing with the Calhoun against the tariffs to, like, spur manufacturing, right? It's the entrenched capital powers, which at that point was slavery. Later on, it gets, you know, less acutely, obviously, the exploitative, like, you get some removes from, you know, the wage labor and all this sort of stuff, but it's still the exact same thing. You still had, like, complete domination by oligarchic classes in the South, right?
I was gonna say also, and I guess this would be in response to the last clip you played, but, you know, a lot of this story gets down to, you know, just they were stating their case, right? Like, this economic liberty, right? Like, this is, government is theft, right? Mm-hmm. Like, why should they be giving up this capital? And it's just, you know, this fallacy that, right, that, you know, Obama didn't phrase it well, right? You know,
you didn't, he was like,
you didn't build that.
He's right.
But the truth is, well, the truth is that you did build it, but you built it on a foundation that was paid for and provided by public tax dollars over many years, you know,
yeah,
like
using subsidized materials.
You hired people, guess what? They're probably trained at public or educated at public schools, mm-hmm. you know. You transported goods, you probably did it over roads built by public tax dollars, right? You're using our legal system,
telecommunications,
right? Arguably, when you build companies, you're using more of the system, you know. You owe something for that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you pay it back. It's not just yours. It's not just, right, to fetishize this wealth. It's, you know, we, in our group chat, we had, you know, there was a story, Lance Armstrong is teasing how much mm-hmm. money he made off his Uber investment. He made $100,000 investment in Uber when it was worth like $3.7 million or something really small. And now it's worth $120 billion. And he didn't like say what it'd be worth. But if you assume that number grows commensurate with the valuation, you know, it could be as much as $3.2 billion, okay? Which is like, so if you just assume, right, and if you agree with this, like, far right-wing libertarian view that, like, now he's a billionaire. He, like, is an elite. Like, he earned that, like, that he really, I mean, he got fantastically, you know, lucky or whatever.
Right.
But to assume that he then, like, gets more rights because he just got, like, stupid lucky with that, right? Like, you have $3 billion all of a sudden. Like, even in Uber, okay, cool, you invested in Uber. Guess what? Like, Uber wouldn't exist if they didn't have all these
people with disposable income in this country to have customers to, right? They wouldn't exist if the U.S. government hadn't bailed out the auto industries, right? During the crash. They wouldn't exist if the government hadn't invented the internet and the computer, which, you know, eventually became your smartphone, right? Like, so there's been...
Ask Fairchild Semiconductor, which... private company or / United States government was buying the fucking semiconductors to make them reach an economy of scale.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, it's like, but you have to, I mean, that's just a fundamental, you know, fallacy from their position.
Yeah. Simon Malloy, where's he at now? He is a writer for Media Matters. He had this tweet, Jamie Dimon in September was trolling Trump a little bit, saying I could beat him and I'm richer than him. Saying like I've got $1.4 billion. And Simon Malloy tweeted out, wow, I did not know Jamie Dimon did $1.4 billion worth of bank labor. And when you put it that way, it's like, yeah, obviously. So in conclusion, I think we're both still in agreement that Nancy McLean's putting on notice of this libertarian economics movement as fundamentally deceitful and intending to serve oligarchic interests, while perhaps not done in the cleanest way, maybe it gets a bit messy, it's still fundamentally the right message, and a message that I think you should comfortably tell people to buy this book now. And I would say this, yeah, don't get this idea that Buchanan is this Machiavelli, but he's certainly in the right position in a lot of these cases to if he had some bright ideas about how like Pinochet should, you know, protect against the evils of progressive taxation, he was there.
Or if you read it and you like it and you feel like you want a sober, drier view, read Dark Money. Yep. Or if you think you already have that disposition in advance, then read Dark Money.
Or Sons of Wichita is also good, even before Dark Money, that came out on the Koch brothers. But just to drive home the fact that this is a fundamentally dishonest, and even, I'm not saying like Michael Munger's being dishonest. I think he's interested. Like his career depends on this not being seen as thinly veiled, motivated reasoning in defense of oligarchy. Or maybe not even thinly veiled, like very, you know, like...
Well, he made a career of it, basically, right?
Yeah.
And if she invalidates it, then what does that mean for his career?
And right, so. I think but the point is, anytime something comes out of what the George Mason University Mercatus Center, which Buchanan was instrumental in founding, I don't know if he's the only founder, but he's definitely there. Maybe we should just pick that up.
Oh, I was surprised. I had forgot, too, that... that Fred Koch was a founding member of the Birch Society.
Oh yeah. Yeah, hell yeah. Oh yeah. So George Mason University is home as of 1997 of the James Buchanan Center. So yeah, what's this Buchanan stuff been up? There's disinterested market oriented ideas. What have they been doing lately? Well, they've been trying to fight the Medicare for All push. In a way that turned out to be dishonest. Basically, to just summarize before we go to Bernie's policy director to close us out, they studied Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All proposal, found out that it was going to cost $32 trillion. Didn't mention that one of their estimates had that saving overall the American people $2 trillion, despite covering every single person. And when it was pointed out by Matt Brunig of the People's Policy Project, the left-wing think tank, check it out on Patreon, they went into complete spin mode that I think is just transparently dishonest. And here's Bernie Sanders, Warren Gunnels, Senator Sanders' policy director, with a bit of music to close us out. Chris, thank you for being here.
Always a pleasure.
And we will see you next week.
I have a question for the Koch brothers-funded Mercatus Center. Why are you trying to hide the truth about Medicare for All? The Mercatus Center at George Mason University is a libertarian think tank backed by the Koch brothers. The Koch-funded think tank recently released a study that found the American people would save $2 trillion over 10 years under Medicare for All. But they don't want you to know that Medicare for All will actually save us money as a country. So when they wrote up an analysis of their findings, they conveniently forgot to mention this fact in their analysis. Instead, they tried to scare us by saying that the government would spend $32.6 trillion over 10 years if it had implemented Senator Sanders' Medicare for All legislation. Legislation that would guarantee health insurance to everyone in this country, including the 30 million Americans who are uninsured. You can't blame the author, Chuck Vlahos, for being embarrassed that not everyone bought his spin. He tried to write a study scaring people away from Medicare for All, but ended up making the case for Senator Sanders' plan. Now Chuck has been pitching his shocking $32 trillion finding to reporters. But when people actually read his report and highlighted the $2 trillion in savings he buried in it, he said he didn't highlight that figure because he doesn't think it's realistic. And the corporate media fact checkers have been eating up his spin. Well, I'm sorry, Chuck, but there is a new fact checker in town.